Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, Grassroots Art, a New Hampshire artist campaign to grow a museum out of wheat. And Brady Carlson joins us with his roundup of web news and oddities and asks, with all the incredulous material on the web each day, has the internet killed the April Fool's joke? And so we begin with a story that defies credibility. Descendants of escaped slaves still thriving in the Brazilian forest. Of the 5 million Africans brought to the Portuguese colony of Brazil, thousands escaped into the dense rainforest to live freely in isolated communities called quilombos. Many of their descendants still live there today. And today, the vast mineral and agricultural potential of the rainforest threatens the quilombolas, as residents call themselves, and their rights to land that they've cultivated for hundreds of years. Susanna Hecht and Charles Mann visited several quilombos, many largely unchanged since the 18th century, for a National Geographic story called Where Slaves Ruled. Susanna Hecht is professor at the Luskin School of Public Affairs and author of Fate of the Forest, Developers, Destroyers, and Defenders of the Amazon. Her book, The Scramble for the Amazon, comes out this summer. Susanna, great to have you with us.
I'm so thrilled to be on talking to you.
Well, the Portuguese colony of Brazil was the center of the slave trade. Can you give us an idea of the scale relative to other parts of the world?
Well, if you want to, the Portuguese were the slavers par excellence, and there were 100,000 slaves just in Lisbon in the 1400s. So they had kind of mastered the movement of slaves all through the world. But if you wanted to think about the massive number of slaves that went into Brazil compared and into Amazonia, you might want to think about a place like Suriname, which we don't even, it's called the Dutch Antilles, here, the Dutch part of the Amazon. A little country had more slaves come into it than all the United States.
Wow.
So we're looking at a kind of dynamic that was really much more massive than I think people normally appreciate. And I think also people think, well, there were slaves that went into maybe Rio de Janeiro or Bahia, you know, but that the Amazon is really this sort of wild place with maybe a few smatterings of Indians and basically sort of wild nature, when in fact it was really deeply and profoundly occupied by these slave communities that really fled for their lives, because the average lifespan of a slave in Brazil was about 6 years. So the choice was sort of being worked to death or having the boldness to be free.
And many did escape to these quilombos, like Palmares, which is now a national park. Now, it has some legendary origins. Tell us about this.
Well, it was founded by, and the legend has it, an Angolan princess named Akwaltune. And she fled with her warriors to this area, which was also an Indian village that was full of resistance. It's an incredible site. It's this giant sort of mountain that rises out of the plain. It has a lot of artesian water in it so that you could stay there. And it became a site of resistance to Portuguese incursions into the interior of Brazil. And it was a place of resistance and fought mightily for more than 100 years. It also has to be seen as kind of a polity, that it was set up as kind of an independent nation. And I think one of the things people forget when they think about quilombos is they think, oh, it's just a little village somewhere. But these were systems of villages, and you see them all over, actually, the interior of Brazil and Amazonia, where there'll be like 50 or 60 villages that will be called quilombo something or other, you know? And essentially what happened in Palmares is that it was seen as an alternative nation. It was called Angola Janga, which means little Angola, by people who were coming in. And the significance of the name and of the polity wasn't lost on arriving slaves. They saw it as an independent nation. And some of these nations, like some in Suriname, for example, continued on and fought mightily against the Dutch. They fought mightily against Brazilians in order to have their autonomy. So in the case of the Saramaca, they signed a peace treaty with the Dutch, which basically maintained their land holdings and so on until dams were built and the sort of recent modern era. But what was key about Quilombos was that they used the landscape to hide.
Mm.
So unlike this, what we think about as occupation, which is you sort of clear land and grow stuff and so on, what these communities lived from were trees and tubers and being hard to get to. So the landscape itself was a kind of an ally, as well as African techniques of drop traps and all sorts of, you know, wild things. But these were areas that used the natural environment to protect themselves. And if you're using your livelihood based on trees and tubers, for Europeans it's very difficult to see that in the tropics. It just looks like trees and tubers, you know. And so what happens is that many areas that everyone, you know, is admiring for their beautiful wild nature, in essence, are manipulated forests that have been really important for both subsistence and for protection by these communities. So you have a situation now where many areas that people yearn for as conservation zone turn out to be actually inhabited landscapes.
We're talking about Quilombos. These are villages settled by escaped slaves in the Brazilian rainforest, and people still live there, their descendants. Susanna Hecht is with us. She wrote about the pressures on the land by developers and environmentalists for National Geographic. Her book, The Scramble for the Amazon, comes out this summer, and you can see a selection of some of the pictures of life in the Quilombos today at wordofmouthradio.org. So we're talking about a long and quite brutal history of the indigenous people in Brazil and the development of the forest and the government. Now, this has gone through several different mutations. It's a very complicated, sometimes very violent history over land between the indigenous people, miners, ranchers, and development. So how is it now deeded or treated in parts of Brazil that are considered by many to be just wilderness and lawless?
Well, in 1988, there was a constitution convention in Brazil, and you might want to think about 1776, where things are sort of set out for what will be the way the nation functions. What you might want to think about in the case of the Brazilian one was that instead of being white land-holding men, this had participants from indigenous nations, from black communities, from all sorts of different elements of civil society. But the most important thing was what's called Article 88, which basically ceded land to its traditional occupants. So that if you could show that you had been inhabiting a landscape for a long time, then you could start a process for having your land rights and property rights recognized. This was the foundation legislation that led to the extractive reserves, and many of your listeners might have heard about Chico Mendes.
Mm-hmm.
And,
who was killed defending
the rainforest.
Yeah,
the sort of rainforest martyr, really.
Mm-hmm.
But people really didn't have Quilombos on their horizon, and especially not in Amazonia. They sort of understood this to be the case for, you know, places like Bahia that received so many of the slave ships, but so they thought, well, a couple of old guys will get their land, you know, their little cultivation plots, and that will be that. And they were sort of taken aback when basically
something like 1700 came out of the woodwork. Is that
more
so?
Than that? Mm-hmm. The numbers are always going up, partly because as these land conflicts become sharper, people start to claim them more, and also that the process has developed more in the last decades.
Well,
and so people know about it more.
Susanna, one of the things I want to get to before we leave is the catch for many that this land, once it's under environmental protection, residents aren't allowed to use it in the ways that they traditionally have. So as you were just saying, you know, they cultivated this land, they made it their own, that is their proof of deed on some level. And then they're not able to cultivate the land as they once did. What's the catch here, and how can they get over that?
Well, Brazil has a rather different view of wild lands, I think, than what we have. We have sort of pure conservation, and it is true that there are pure conservation areas in the Amazon. But about half of those, 60% of the conservation areas in Amazonia are actually areas of that have either indigenous populations, traditional peoples of various kinds, whether rubber tappers, quilombolas, and so on. So in essence, while when we think of conservation areas as being sort of separated out from the human people and human processes that transform these landscapes, in essence, what the Brazilian conservation laws have allowed is the possibility for people to continue their livelihoods in these areas. And you can see also that with things like new legislation for things like RED, which is reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation, that our occupied landscapes are now becoming kind of an important part of that. So what we're seeing is a shift from conservation as an isolation and as a sort of part of a biological history to beginning to see Amazonian forests as the outcome of social history.
Well, it's a fascinating history indeed, and I really want to thank you for sharing some of it with us today, Susanna.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Susanna Hecht is a specialist on the Latin American tropics, especially the Amazon. She's author of Fate of the Forest and two upcoming books, The Scramble for the Amazon and The Social Lives of Forests. She and Charles C. Mann wrote about the fate of the quilombos for the National Geographic. And for a link to the article and a selection of some of the stunning photographs there by Tyrone Turner, you can visit wordofmouthradio.org. Now stay with us for a very different twist on homegrown culture, growing a museum out of wheat. That's when Word of Mouth continues. In just a minute, this is NHPR.